Freddie, for having me here. It's a great pleasure. It's my first visit here, and it's a thoroughly enjoyable environment. And I get a cool hockey stick. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about work that I've been doing on quiver theories, quiver gauge theories, especially in the context of bipartite graphs. So this is it's a fun topic involving a field theory, combinatorics, and algebraic geometry. Let me begin by thanking my various collaborators. So I'm going to talk about a few papers I've been doing over the years. So I'd like to thank these various collaborators of mine. And hopefully, but towards the end of the talk, I'll talk about some of the more recent stuff that I've been doing with the London group, and also with the Canadian group, and also one with my student, James Reed. So let me begin by enticing you with two of the most famous superconformal field theories, the ones that everybody knows and loves. Let me just begin with n equal to 4 UN Super-Yamil's theory. This is a theory, as well known, if I write it in n equal to 1 language in 4 dimensions, it's 3 adjoint fields with this particular superpotential consisting of 2 cubic terms. Now, of course, this is a famous theory that was sort of the initiation of what's become known as ADA-CFT correspondence, as we have ND brains transfers to the simplest of all Clabian manifolds, namely the flat R6. I'm going to write this in a quiver language just to set the notation. Nodes here are gauge groups, and arrows here are bifundamental or adjoint fields, as you wish. So here, the n equal to 4 Yamil's theory is just what we call the clover quiver, because this looks like a clover. So these are the XYZ, and then we have the node. So in general, a quiver is a finite labeled graph with possible relations. So this is a standard thing coming from representation theory mathematics. But here, we can just simply capture the matter content and superpotential interactions in terms of this finite graph with possible label. So the nice thing is that you do impose formal relations on these arrows by imposing the F terms coming from supersymmetry. In this particular case, you simply take the critical points of the superpotential, and you have all of these arrows formally commuting. Just like to point out a perhaps a less emphasized fact of this particular theory is that the number of gauge factors in this is 1. There's a single node. The number of fields is 3 because there are 3 arrows. And the number of terms in the superpotential is 2. And now this is going to play a very important combinatorial role for us. Now let's move on to another very famous and very well-studied superconformal field theory in 4 dimensions. This is a very old work due to Klebanov and Witten, and what's come to be known as the conifold theory with n equal to 1 supersymmetry. Yeah. Yes, you can. Yeah. Yeah, you can represent the hypermultiplets as you wish. Yeah. But I'm going to emphasize n equal to 1 here. This is a theory of SUN cross SUN gauge groups. So there are 2 nodes, and it comes with 4 bifundamental fields with a quartic superpotential that's become standard. So there are these 2 fields. Now, the reason that this is called the conifold theory is because in string, there's a string theory realization of this. You put ND brains, D3 brains, instead of transfers to the simplest Clabian manifold, non-compact Clabian manifold of C3, you put to the next simplest one, which is a quadric hypersurface in C4. And this is one of the very first Clabian manifolds, non-compact Clabian manifolds that was emphasized. So you can check this very quickly. Indeed, if you set n equal to 1, you get 4 different types of gauge invariants, namely AI, BJ, and they obey a single relation, which is this one. So indeed, the general rule is that if you just find closed loops in the quiver, the relations among these closed loops will generate for you, up to the extra conditions imposed by the F terms, the algebraic variety, which is the underlying Clabian manifold. Now, let me write this again, this simple combinatorial fact. Here, there are 2 gauge fields, 4 fields, and 2 terms in the superpotential. So this is sort of the starting point of just a combinatorial experimental observation, which has come to become a quiet industry of itself. So the curious observation is that if you take this combination, it's always equal to 0. Now, this is true for almost every single known theory to the 85 CFT correspondence. This is a combinatorial fact which is perhaps less emphasized, but it is true. And part of the first part of the talk is to explain why this is the case. I keep on charging myself. I'm discharging myself onto the computer. This is quite interesting. And there's a capacitance that's playing around. So those just entice you with these two particular theories. And let me just state the general case. Now this is the most general case of any good one in four dimensions. So in generically, you're given some kind of action in any good one language. We have some superpotential with some polynomial from which you have the effective potential integrated in the standard way by integrating over the superspace. And there it comes in the particular two terms, the F terms that I talked about and the D terms that I talked about as well. So these will now impose formal relations in the arrows of your quiver if your theory is a quiver theory. Of course, this is more general. And then these will be sort of gauge invariant operators come in your theory. So the idea is that for general n equal to 1 gauge theory in four dimensions, you can always compute the vacuum moduli space as the space of solutions to these two equations as algebraic equations. And this is why it always defines some kind of affine, possibly singular algebraic variety. And in the mathematics literature, they do talk about these things, and sometimes it's called a representation variety of a quiver. This particular correspondence becomes a very interesting thing, especially in the context of string theory, because if you compute this and you get a Clavier threefold, an affine Clavier threefold, you can realize this as D3 brains probing a particular manifold of this type. So you sort of see a bijection here, because what you do is you have a stack of brains, and the brains can move. And by sort of by construction, what it moves is the transverse direction. So as far as the Clavier variety is concerned, your D brains would just be a point. And vice versa, given this particular geometry, and you want to construct what the gauge theory there is, so you have these two directions. So this side of going from the geometry to the gauge theory has been called by Waffa, Freddy, and many people it's been called geometrical engineering. It's as if you're engineering a particular gauge theory. And the other direction of actually computing this, well, I would just call this the forward algorithm for lack of imagination. I'd just like to emphasize that if you, this is really the situation of a single brain. When you have n parallel stacks of brains in string theory, you really should talk about the variety as a symmetric product due to the shuffling symmetry of your brains. Gosh, right. So here's a fun thing to do, and it's something I've been doing with my collaborators, these various collaborators of mine, which is just to think this is slightly related to the current context. I mean, you can always do this and try to find, you know, take your favorite gauge theory and just do brute force and compute its D terms and F terms. You can imagine this becomes an extremely difficult problem once you have many fields and many potential gauge invariant operators. We can always do this simply because I won't go into the details of this. You can rephrase this entire computation because it's purely polynomial by playing with appropriate ideals, polynomial ideals. So at the end of the day, what you're basically doing is a Grobner reduction of the basis of our ideals. And you can always get something at the end of the day. So one of the things we're playing with right now is, you know, take your favorite n equal to 1 theory, the MSSM. This is a theory that has effective something like 60 component fields and about 1,000 gauge invariant operators. Certainly, you don't want to do this by hand. And ideally, you want to put this on a supercomputer. And this is something that I would like to know, for example, what is the vacuum moduli space of the MSSM. It's quite interesting. We played a little bit with SQCD, and you get very high dimensional Clavier varieties, which is slightly unexpected. So let me just summarize the context that we are going to focus in, which is this sort of deep brain probe approach. You don't really have to have this approach, but for the kind of structure that I'm going to talk about, that strange combinatorial formula that I wrote earlier, this becomes very pronounced in this particular setup. So just to summarize, the kind of algebraic varieties that people have been looking at. So this is sort of a Venn diagram of this object here that people have been doing over the number of years. This is a topologically correct but numerically definitely not correct Venn diagram. There are many, many more of these, just because I couldn't fit. So you can think about, you know, generic orbifolds. So these are types of, you know, C3 quotient by discrete finite subgroups of SU3 to preserve the Clabialness. And this is a huge family of the so-called toric varieties, and I'm going to focus on this family. Now, this includes such famous things as conifold and this more exotic spaces called LPQLABC spaces. At the intersection, you have a billion orbifolds. So all abelian quotients of C3 have toric description. And then there are other discrete families, like, you know, Delpezzo families, and, you know, they have various interesting intersections within this Venn diagram. So the one I'm going to focus on is this one. The examples that I mentioned earlier, the C3 theory and the conifold theory, of course, all here. Right, so, and indeed, this family is by far the largest class known and studied. For two reasons, really. Well, first of all, is, you know, the world volume physics here, and the gauge theory data here is succinctly summarized in terms of combinatorial data. So this is the power of toric varieties. It's because you can essentially boil down all of your geometry down to the combinatorics of integer cones and lattices. I'm just going to give a diagram in a minute. And there's been a long history of computing this moduli space I was talking about using Witten's GLSM construction. And you can also go backwards in terms of an algorithm. And a nice fact, perhaps one of the nicest facts about these toric varieties, is that we know explicit Ricci-flat metrics for these manifolds. In fact, they're the only known explicit Ricci-flat Clabian metrics. Of course, we don't know any compact ones. This is still an open problem in mathematics. The ones I'm talking about are local or affine or non-compact varieties, and the ones that we know. So the first one that was ever constructed was due to this beautiful work of Gandalas de la Osa for the conifold. And then there are these more general works due to various people here. So these are very nice manifolds because the dual cone has a lot of isometry, and that allows us to compute the kind of metric that you want to know. So I'm not going to talk about really the details of toric varieties. I'd just like to just sort of set the notation of the kind of combinatorial things that we're going to encounter. There are really sort of three equivalent definitions of toric varieties. One is combinatorial in terms of cones. One is in terms of symplectic quotient using charges. Here's an example of the conifold. And one that's really not so much emphasized is this computational one. So this is a theorem due to Sturmfels that says every ideal which is a binomial ideal, so if you just write down the ideal of your polynomials, if they sort of, after change of variables, they become product equal to product, then the result is also toric variety. So as you can see explicitly in our case. So this is probably the simplest working definition of a toric variety, I'm going to use this property, right? And this one, I'm just to set the notation, really, what we're going to boil down is for a Clabial threefold, the toric diagram for that is always a planar, that's due to the Clabialness, grid of points. So all we do for this kind of geometry is we just have to look at grid points in Z2. So that's a very nice description of a geometry. So now let's go back to try to trace our story and see where we go. So the next two slides will be slightly boring and technical. So I will summarize again with a summary graph, so you can sleep for the next 5 minutes. So of course, the first immediate thing you recognize is that this relation is the Euler relation for a torus, if this torus were to exist. Now, why would there be such a torus is sort of the question that we would like to pursue. So just to remind you, G is the number of nodes in your toric diagram. In your quiver diagram, which you can see it is actually related to the volume of your toric diagram as a grid of points. E is the number of edges in your superconformal field theory, and NT is the number of faces on this torus. So I'm going to draw for you this torus in a minute. So the quiver itself gets, you know, what does the quiver itself actually represent? It has space of loops according to how you trace the arrows in your quiver that has representation of your fields. And what you're doing is you're taking the space of such closed loops modulo the relations that are imposed by supersymmetry. It turns out that if you take the dual of the toric diagram, D, it becomes a PQ configuration of brains. It turns out further that if the repetition, there's a certain repetition symmetry in this toric description, that this repetition will come precisely in the multiplicities in the homogeneous coordinate that describes the toric variety. I'm going to be more specific in a minute when I summarize this diagram. Given such a quiver, what you can do is you can draw the dual periodic quiver. So this is a colored graph dual of your quiver. So this you can actually, it turns out you can do this for all such quiver theories. So what you do is you notice the fact that the superpotential terms are precisely, because you're toric, they must be a binomial ideal. So something must equal to something. Now if you think about where such a thing will come from, right, because your F terms are partial derivatives of a single polynomial, and in order that this derivative comes to be some product of a monomial equal to polynomial, it must be that each field appears exactly twice in your superpotential with opposite sign in order to take this derivative. So that's exactly the definition of the binomial ideal definition of the toric variety. So this is nice. This plus minus sign is really the origin of the bipartiteness that I'm going to show in a minute. So because, you know, every time you have really a concept of a plus and a minus, you can start assigning directions or bipartite structure to your graph. That's fine. And then this, it turns out that you can actually draw this graph periodically on a plane, and that's the origin of this torus. So in other words, what you end up in the day is if your moduli space of your gauge theory is a toric Klabiel variety, then this is the equivalent description of this is a diamond model on a torus. By diamond model, I simply mean, you know, a collection of black white nodes. So, you know, now we've entered the realm of statistical mechanics. It's an old fact, you know, once you have dimers, one of the first things you want to do is to count how many possible ways to link them, right? And then this was a famous work due to Castellane. What you do is you construct a weighted adjacency matrix of your dimer model, and you take the determinant, and it will start to count how many possible different matchings, perfect matchings of this as they are. Now, it turns out that the determinant of this Castellane matrix will be a two-variable polynomial that counts the perfect matchings. And it turns out that these coefficients of this bivariate polynomial will be precisely the multiplicities that I alluded to earlier that count the repetitions of the nodes. So there is a mirror picture to all of this. So it's a standard fact due to Uguri, Wafa, Iqbal, and many people, and Hori, is that, you know, if I give you a local Klabiel manifold of the type that we're thinking about, which is a local toric Klabiel manifold, what is its local mirror? And in fact, very nicely, there's a precise description. All you have to do is to it has very explicit equations, namely this one. So what you do is you're given a toric diagram of a Klabiel threefold, you find the Newton polynomial for this toric diagram. That is the polynomial which counts the exponents or the lattice points, because we have two coordinates on your lattice points, and then this two the intersection of these two hypersurfaces in C5 will give you the explicit equation of your mirror Klabiel. So you can see this as sort of as a double vibration over z plane, And then you can show that indeed there is, if you draw from point to point of where the Z degenerates, you actually have a topological equivalent to S3s, so Lagrangian three cycles. And it is indeed the intersection of these S3s that govern the quiver structure. The adjacency matrix of your quiver will be precisely the intersection matrix of your S3s. So this is nice. So that's it. Last bit of fun game that you can do. I'm going to summarize this in a minute, so I'm going to wake you up in 2 minutes. There are two standard projections that one can do to algebraic varieties. So this is sort of the realm of tropical geometry. So two things that people can do is one is called amoeba projection, and the other is called the co-amoeba or the alga projection. So what you do is you're not given any algebraic variety, and here we have something described in terms of two variables, and you just take this log map. And it turns out that the skeleton of this is an algebraic set in two dimensions. It's a set of points. It's not an algebraic variety because of this log absolute value business. And if you take the skeleton of this projection, it turns out to be precisely the PQ configuration. And the alternative projection is to take the argument of this ZW. And then you project it again, and it turns out that if you contract this, it'll give you precisely the fundamental region of the dimer. So it's nice that it's the intersection of the T3 fibers when you do mirror symmetry that gives you this periodic tiling structure that happens in this algebraic projection. So now I'm going to summarize everything I've talked about in a very specific way, so you can wake up again. Oh, it's just a bit of technical stuff of why. Have to go through this story. So let me just illustrate everything I've talked about in terms of the conifold theory that I mentioned earlier. So let's start with this theory. This is the SUN cross SUN theory here, or here if you can take it to U1 cross U1 if you wish, with these four fields, and with this particular, if you expand out all the epsilon, you get this two quartic terms in your superpotential. So this is your starting point. Now you notice that you can draw this on a torus in the following way. Now note the thing about quivers is that they come with a superpotential which is imposed, right? I mean, I could have written a different superpotential, and I could have imposed that formally on the variables of my arrows. But that will not necessarily give me the conifold as its moduli space anymore. It may give me something else. But it's for this choice of superpotential that I'm guaranteed that the moduli space indeed is toric Kleiber-Yau and is indeed the quadric surface in C4. So that's a good thing. But the structure here is quite rigid. So it's so rigid, in fact, I can encapsulate this two pieces of data in terms of a single one. So what I do is I draw this quiver periodically, right? So I've just extended the arrows as A1, A2, et cetera, and then make this identification. This is node 1, this is node 2. So this is an infinite periodic quiver. But now the nice thing, you notice that the counterclockwise directions and the clockwise directions are exactly the two superpotentials that emerge here and nothing else. Now this only happens, as far as we know, to the kind of toric Kleiber-Yau manifolds that we're talking about. This is really nice. So we get this one for free. This graph has both pieces of information. So fine, given this structure, what we can do is to take the graph dual of this and a directioned graph dual. And by saying that every time that I see something that goes counterclockwise, I'm going to contract it to a node, which is black. And everything that is clockwise, I'm going to contract it to a node, which is white. So the graph dual of this, essentially where you replace every face, you contract it to a node, every edge by its perpendicular direction. So this is why that this particular quiver gauge theory is now equivalently expressed as a bipartite graph periodically drawn in a plane. In other words, a dimer model on a torus. So that's this side of the story. Okay, fine, that's nice. Now, let's just go back here for a minute. What is the underlying geometry to this quiver gauge theory? And as I said, it's the quadric surface in C4. Right, the quadric surface in C4 is the conifold, and it, as I said, is Clavier threefold, toric Clavier threefold. It must be representable in terms of a finite point of grid points in Z2. And it turns out to be this particular one. This is the famous toric diagram for the conifold. Great. So now let's look at what the Newton polynomial of this conifold is. Well, the coordinates are here. So you introduce two dummy variables, call it Z and W. You get 1 plus 1 plus Z plus W plus ZW. So we'll remember that. The reason we need to know the Newton polynomial for this object is because we're told in local mirror symmetry, the defining equation of the mirror Clavier manifold is this Newton polynomial equal to Z equal to UV. Right? So let's just keep this Newton polynomial in the back of our minds. Now, given this dimer, Castellane tells us in order to count how many different ways can you match black with white, all you need to do is to draw two cycles, fundamental cycles of your torus, call it Z and W, judiciously named, and then you just find its weighted intersection numbers with the Z and W and take its determinant, which here turns out to be this one. Right. So in other words, well, I mean, this is this sort of weighted size. In other words, there are four ways to count to do this perfect matching, which is this one, this one, this one, this one. Nicely, this is exactly the Newton polynomial for this toric diagram. So that completes this side of the story. Now, in this particular case, you can also, there are cute ways to compute the quiver from the point of view of the toric diagram directly. What you do here is to construct what's known as the PQ web description of the toric diagram. What you do is you simply take a resolution of this and then do its dual diagram in terms of this. And now the intersection form is just, you know, if you just keep track of what these vectors are, call it PI, QI for each one of them, and then the determinant of PI, QI, PJ, QJ will be precisely the intersection of whether between 1 and 2 you get an error or not, depending whether it's 0. So that completes this side of the story. Now, that's not all. This is cute, because what you can do is you can take this Castellane matrix, the determinant of the Castellane matrix, which we now know to be the Newton polynomial of a toric diagram. You can do two things in tropical geometry, which is to do these two particular projections. One is called the amoeba projection, and the other is the alga projection. The amoeba projection, so only this is nice. I mean, just like to emphasize what you really get here. I mean, at end of the day, the determinant of your Castellane matrix will always be a bivariate polynomial. In other words, you will always define for it some kind of auxiliary Riemann surface. And this amoeba projection will just sort of be the flattened version of your punctured Riemann surface here. And then this PQ web is precisely what algebraic geometers call the spine of this amoeba. Of course, in the notation, the names for these things are all wrong, because amoeba, I don't even know why they call amoeba. I think they call amoeba because the guy who discovered it was from a tropical climate, and his friend wanted to say there are lots of amoeba in tropical climates.
Is the PQ web in any way have to do with tropical geometry?
Yeah, absolutely. The PQ web is exactly the contraction of your amoeba. Yeah, absolutely. To complete the story, the nice thing is that the alternate projection, which is the alga, what we call alga, but apparently mathematicians have discovered this before in unpublished works. This is very typical of algebraic geometers. They don't publish their things; they put it in their drawers, and so you can call this an alga, what we call an alga or a co-amoeba projection, which is simply to take this as a Riemann definition of an affine variety corresponding to a Riemann surface, and then do the argument projection. Right? Remember, this is to get from here to here, you do the log absolute value, and then, or you can take the argument, just log of the phase, and that gives you this periodic drawing of this diagram. And then you can see indeed the contraction of this in the sense of the tropical limit will give back to your diamond model. So that comes, I've given you a very simple example here of the conifold because it's very familiar, but you can imagine it gets very, very complicated for very complicated theories. But it's just nice that we have this sort of this unified way of understanding this in the case of toric geometry. The origin of bipartiteness comes from this, the fact that your superpotential comes with the plus minus terms. And that sort of is built into the definition of your toric variety. So, well, one of the most important things you can do with any n equal to 1 gauge theory is to do Zeibrich duality. Let's just play and see what happens as we do this. So this is sort of part two of the talk. I've just sort of summarized the structure that is emphasizing the lesson that we've learned from part one is that I start with some almost generic n equal to 1 super conformal field theory in 4 dimensions, and I compute its vacuum moduli space by computing its D terms and F terms. If such a moduli space turns out to be a Clapeyard manifold, which is affine and toric, then an equivalent description of that is a bipartite graph drawn periodically on a plane or drawn on a torus. That's a very nice fact. This is the reason why you see that constraint, the combinatorial constraints, constraint from the beginning, the number of gauge groups, my number of fields, plus the number of faces in your thing is equal to 0. So now let's see how Zeibrich duality shows up in this picture. So this is just some standard fact about Zeibrich duality. So this is, you can always generate your superpotential by doing this duality within the conformal window. So one thing that is nice about Zeibrich duality is in that they have, for our purposes, they have the same infrared dynamics. In other words, this particular move for our gauge theories should produce for you the same vacuum moduli space. So this is something that there have been many interpretations given on this realization in terms of duality. So this Freddy and Vafa and Davide have all done very nice work in this particular direction. But I'm going to do it here in terms of a rule on the quiver graph and as a rule on this bipartite graph. So if you just interpret this, this is the standard duality move as a quiver move, which I won't get into the details of it, but you can check that what you do is, you fix a particular node in your quiver because quivers, each node of a quiver is a gauge group. So if you want to do Zeibrich dual with respect to that gauge group, you end up having this particular dual quiver that you can construct from here. See, this is interesting. That's something I learned last week. I had always thought that mathematicians knew about this before Zeibrich. But yesterday, I think last week, Freddy tells me it's actually the emergence of this particular rule as a quiver move was actually after, or they're certainly independent. This is rather strange, right? It's quite remarkable that Zeibrich was thinking about something pure field theory in terms of dualities of quantum field theories, and mathematicians were thinking about the pure problem of representation theory of quivers, and they arrived at the same rule, which says that if you do this rule, for Zeibrich, it's that the quantum field theories are equivalent, they're dual. For mathematicians, this is something that it says it'll give the same representation variety for your quiver. This is quite remarkable. It's sort of this evolutionary convergence, if you wish. So I mean, graphically, this looks very pretty, right? There are lots of examples. We've just given a few. So I'm going to restrict myself to within the class of toric Zeibrich duality. So in other words, so one thing you can see immediately that because of this NF minus NC, I will only consider the ones that preserve this property. In other words, I have two incoming and two outgoing arrows for each, because this is toric, so I have U1 theories. The ones, the 2 minus 1 will remain 1 for this kind of theory. So you know, this is kind of cute. So you can, you know, for example, you can check that both this one and this quiver are they have the moduli space which is a cone over P1 cross P1, otherwise known as the zeroth Herzberg surface. And then you know there are the examples, and then there are more exotic examples like these. It's remarkable. Just by looking at the quiver, there's no way you would have guessed that they have the same moduli space, and yet they do because of this construction of this quiver move. So as I say, there've been many perspectives on the Seiberg duality. So in the mirror, if you do thrice T duality, there, as I said, the quiver diagrams are obtained by intersection of Lagrangian three cycles, and there this quiver rule becomes what's known as Picard-Lefschetz transformations around a certain vanishing cycle. And you can, I don't really work on this perspective. There's been lots of work also in this direction. There's a sheaf description of this within the derived category in type 2b, in which this Seiberg duality, this quiver move becomes a mutation of exceptional collections of certain sheaves of Kleibiel. So this is Walscher and Herzog. They've done lots of nice work in this direction as well. And more recently, this is something that I don't understand at all, and I would very much like to understand its relation, is that there are certain mutations of matrix variables in cluster algebras that also obey this strange relation, especially in recent work. That's one of my collaborators on Skype. Sorry, I got to turn that off. You know, this. So recently, this kind of structure has shown up in the work of Akani Hamed, Kachatho, Spradlin, Goncharov, and you know they're trying to understand how this is related to amplitudes of bipartite structures, amplitude. This is what prompted the very first conversation with Son, which is trying to see whether this kind of structure have some kind of a common meeting point. So now let me move to yet another description of the kind of structure that we see. And then this is work done in joint work with Sanjay in the audience, which is sort of I find the most beautiful interpretation of this business. And this is where we get into the whole business with the descendant von Grothendieck. So let's just switch gears. So far I have shown you the bipartite structure of these toric gauge theories. I've shown you how Seiberg duality for these gauge theories show up as mutation, or as you wish, or mutations in your cluster, or as Picard-Lifschitz transformations. You know, take your favorite geometrical interpretation. Now let's try to do something from more towards a number theoretical understanding of this structure. So just to for those not familiar with descendant form, let me just give a quick definition of what the kind of thing that we encounter. So, but always keep in back of your mind, at some point we have to study some kind of a bipartite structure. Somehow I must get black and white. Right. So first of all, let me define for you what a Belli map is. So a Belli map is a rational map from a Riemann surface to P1 ramified only at three points, which you can pick to be 0, 1, and infinity. So this is a remarkable theorem of Belli, is that such a rational map exists if and only if your Riemann surface has a model over the algebraic closure of the rationals. In other words, if this is crazy, right? This is something absolutely insane. I'm quoting Grothendieck here. He says, all you need to check whether a Riemann surface can be defined over Riemann surface is not, write your hyper-elliptic model, y squared is some high-powered polynomial in x with crazy coefficients, right? But these coefficients could be anything, any complex number. But if I can find a map to P1, which is ramified only at three points, then these coefficients will necessarily and sufficiently be algebraic numbers. Right, this is the best handle of of this remarkable algebraicity from a point of view of analyticity. It's probably the only one. So what is a dessin d'enfant, or children's drawing, is the inverse image of the interval from 0 to 1 on your P1. Right? So in other words, it is a bipartite graph on your Riemann surface. So why is that? Well, if you label all of the pre-images of 0 to be white or black, and label all of the ones to be white, and then you have this black-white business. And then all you need to do is to find this. I'm going to be very explicit in a minute with concrete examples. If you just find the inverse image of this rational map, then this will draw for you some kind of connected bipartite graph on your Riemann surface. And it's called children's drawings because they look like children's drawings. I'll show you in a minute. So one thing you can do is to write the ramification data, which is just the valency information of your black and white nodes. Right? So the degree to which it is ramified on P1 by this map, I'm going to record this to be a list of valency data. This is also called a passport in the mathematical literature, because it really is like a sort of a way to identify yourself, but not uniquely. But what about infinity? Infinity, it turns out that the inverse images of infinity actually lives one per face on this dessin. So this is nice. An equivalent description of this is in terms of a permutation triple. And I think Sanjay prefers this description because he's a combinatorist at heart. So what this is, all you have to do is just consider three elements, three psychoelements in the symmetric group of 2D order, where D is the number of edges in your bipartite graph, such that they multiply to 1. In general, when you have more of these things, it's called a constellation. But when in the case of 3, it's called a permutation triple for obvious reasons. And this encodes how the sheets are permuted during this ramification, this covering map to P1. So there's been Sanjay's done a nice work of how to realize this and interpret this in many, many different contexts, ranging from matrix models to this kind of business. And then it turns out that the cycle structure of this precisely encodes this dessin in the way I'm going to show you in a minute. So here it is. So now let's go back to what I mentioned earlier, which is this is our sort of our favorite. Well, it's not n equal to 1; it's n equal to 4. But I've written in n equal to 1 language. So this is n equal to 4 Jahn-Mills theory, and I have these three adjoint fields of the single gauge group, and with these two superpotential cubic terms. The toric diagram, this is indeed a toric variety, because C3 is sort of the simplest toric variety. It's simplest toric Clavier variety, because it's trivially Clavier. And in fact, the toric diagram of that looks just like a grid of 3 points. So that's everything I've talked about earlier. So that's the quiver, the toric diagram, and we also know how to draw this as a bipartite graph on a torus. So what you do is you periodically draw this structure on the plane. So this is easy. There's a single gauge group, so I only have one face in the fundamental region. I have three fields, which are precisely the three edges that come out of the XYZ, and I know it's XYZ for a positive direction, black, or minus XZY in the negative direction, white. In other words, this clover description of n equal to 4 Jahn-Mills is the same as a hexagonal periodic tiling of the plane. So that's everything from before, right? And now, can I find, so that's just a bipartite representation of n equal to 4 Jahn-Mills. I claim that all you need to do is to write this information. You're also done, because this pair uniquely specifies this bipartite graph as a dessin d'enfant. Well, you can check this. So obviously, we've drawn everything on tori, so they're elliptic curves. So I can, in this particular case, my elliptic curve looks like this. And my Berlin map, this is certainly a rational map. In fact, it's just a linear map. And so you can just check it. So you look at the pre-images of 0, which are 0, 1. Sorry, 0, 1. Pre-images of 1 are minus 1, 0. And infinity, infinity gets mapped to infinity. Right, and then you just check local coordinates. You just do Taylor expansion around minus 1, 0. You get the expansion of this, the Taylor series only starts at cubic term. Right, that's what we mean by ramification index 3. It's because locally it starts to cover the map at degree 3. In other words, my things are trivalent. So this is really nice. So I've got really, you know, a lot of equivalent ways of representing n equal to 4 Yamils. I've got the clover, I've got the toric diagram, I've got the bipartite graph on the dimer model on a torus, and I got, I think, my favorite one, which is just a pair of the elliptic curve and its rational map to P1. So, well, a very nice fact is that the reason that why Grothendieck thought this was, he got blown away. It's because the absolute Galois group. So the Galois group is the group of all, the symmetric group of all algebraic extensions of a Q. It actually acts faithfully over the space of Dasein. So this carries a faithful representation of this group. I don't know how to explore this symmetry further, but it would be very interesting to see this. Oh, you know, I mean, I've got n equal to 4 Yamils theorem and the absolute Galois group in the same slide. Maybe this is related to Langlands program. I don't know. And this goes on, right? I can draw this for you again. So let's take the conifold theory. I've got this nice little quiver description, right? In terms of this quartic superpotential and this two-noded quiver. The toric diagram of this is the conifold, which is the quadric surface in C4. That's another one. And now, by the same token, I can do the dual periodic quiver and take the colored graph dual, and that'll give me this, right? So you can just see, you can sort of see there are two faces because there are two groups, and there are four arrows, so there are four inequivalent edges, but this is drawn periodically, and then you can trace all of the relevant information. And now I promise you that this information must also be representable in terms of a unique, in fact, it's unique elliptic curve and its ramified rational map to P1. And it is indeed the case. You can check that this is your elliptic curve, and it's highly non-trivial, right? So you can, you know, you do Taylor expansion of the pre-images of this of 0. I mean, it's a bit of a work, as it is. But it, you know, these are. How many different ways to write the conifold theory? They're all completely equivalent. The information is in complete dialogue. And it goes on. You know, you can get take your favorite. You know, these things. There are huge catalogs of these over the years, right? Because of ADA-CFT, people have been trying to get this n equal to 1 superconformal field theories in four dimensions because toric ones are the only ones that we know the metric. So there's been huge catalogs, LABCs, YPQs, just take your pick. You can find one of these and find its toric diagram and its representative dimer model on the torus. Unfortunately, it is not, we don't have a complete catalog of this because it is really, really, really hard. This is one of those things that mathematicians absolutely love, right? You have this structure. This map exists, but they won't ever tell you what it is. So you can imagine something like this already gives, you know, it gets very complicated. So the catalog of these of this Dessin d'enfance in terms of explicit models are actually very, very sparse. It's a huge computational problem. And in fact, it's an open problem. We don't even have some, this side is easy. All of this is easy now. It would be really nice to start to have a full catalog of this kind of data. I mean, the mathematicians do it. They spend their all their lives trying to construct these explicit ramified maps. Whoops. And you can imagine why this is easy, because you know the space of such maps captures the full information of the absolute Galois group. So these coefficients could get very, very, very big very quickly. Yeah. the belly map from the toric diagram. That's a very good question. Anyway, from here to here, you can start to guess. From here to here, we don't really have a rule other than things like do some obifolds. You may imagine if I have a toric diagram that looks like a triangle, then I know the belly map is the one that I read before. Gosh. Right? And then if I have a quotient of C3, which is a bigger triangle with bigger lattice points, the result of the elliptic curve. So we do have that procedure, which is just to do some kind of a quotient of these two maps. But other than that, we don't have general rules. It would be very nice indeed to have to how to do this. In fact, for a very long time, even getting from here to here was not easy. Right? So traditionally, to get, you know, I throw a random toric diagram at you, and I ask you, what is its gauge theory? The traditional method to do this is to embed this toric diagram in C3 modulo ZK cross ZK for large enough K, just because, you know, that's the big diagram, and I can always do this. Then I just Higgs, right? I can do partial resolutions of this singularity. The partial resolutions of this will give me the what corresponds to Higgsian in the field theory. Then I can get this, and that's it's a bit of a work. But thanks to Dymer technology, there have been nice work of Uranga, Franco, and friends, which now shows that, well, the best way to do this is to translate this into some kind of a dimer and can start pasting dimers. And that's a pretty, they call this the faster or the efficient inverse algorithm. But from here to here, it's very hard. And even from here to here, it's very hard. It's an open problem. So I'd just like to emphasize in the last couple of minutes that the Dessins are rigid. Now, this is something quite different from something that I've mentioned before, right? So far, I have just done topological, quote-unquote topological moves on all of my diagrams. I haven't told you how long the length, you know, with how long the length or what the angles are, right? In terms of my Dymer model, I've just told you it is a bipartite periodic graph, but I haven't told you what the shape of it actually is. But Dessins, on the other hand, are completely rigid objects. This is quite interesting because, in other words, there is no moduli. If I change this number to 2, even something like that, or added 1 to this, it'll give something completely different. Right? It'll give a dimer that has absolutely nothing to do with this one. And it may not even give one at all. So this is quite something quite different. So they're sort of frozen at specific algebraic points in the moduli space of these dimers. And in particular, your elliptic curve comes with a very exact complex structure. Wow. I should wear like a Faraday cage glove or something. Here's a puzzle that we don't actually fully understand, which is to relate this to field theory information. And this is one of the first things that got Sanjay and us, you know, we started talking because of this. So let me go back to pure field theory for a minute. There is a distinguished dimer in your gauge theory. So it's a dimer which corresponds to our charge that has been has undergone a maximization. Let's just go back for a minute. So if you look at the NSVZ beta function for this, for each gauge group, you know, in your generic curve theory, so this is a nice fact of this. And you can, in fact, re-express all of this in terms of the R charges of your fields in your superconformal field theory. Now, conformality requires that the beta functions vanish. So that translates to the condition that 1 minus the R charge for each edge, right, is equal to 2 for every face in your dimer. Supersymmetry also requires that all of my operators in my theory have R charge 2 just to cancel the theta when you do the integration in superspace. So in other words, all of my terms have R charge 2. In other words, all of the for each vertex in my dimer, the sum of all of the R charges equal to 2. So these two conditions. In fact, just by summing this one over all nodes and summing the second one over all faces and just subtract, you get for free this Euler relation. So in other words, the fact that we're forced on tori or on elliptic curves is because of super conformality. But that's, as we know, it's not enough to fix the R charges completely. And so that's nice work of Intrigator Vect, Martelli, Sparks, and Yao, is to A, maximize, or in the ADS dual language, to Z minimize the volume of your Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And there you can just, these two steps is enough to just get this kind of embedding, which is actually turns out to be isoradial embedding. The fact that you can draw all of your dyma on circles. But after you run A maximization or Z minimization, now you've got all your charges fixed, right? There's some algebraic numbers as well, right? It would be really, really nice if these algebraic numbers are precisely the algebraic numbers that you get from the Dessan side because they're rigid. Unfortunately, I cannot say that they are. We can say that they are the case for simple cases like C3 or Conifold or their descendants. But once you get into crazy exotic ones like Del-Petzl surfaces of high degree, they will start to mismatch. So why is that? I don't know. Why is it that the Dessan is picking out a different shape from what conformality is telling me to do? Or you turn that question around. Obviously, the Dessan is picking out particular algebraic points. What are these algebraic points in the space of R charges that we also don't know? To make this puzzle even more bizarre, we can also do the computation in the dual, the ADS side, the Sasaki-Einstein. I mean, I got the metric. These are the only ones that I have the metric. So I can start to integrate and find where these tori are in this picture. If we need to trust this interpretation that the T2 of your dimer lives in the T3 of the thrice T duality of mirror symmetry, this T2 must exist in the Lagrangian 3 cycles. You can find some tori. And again, you get simple matches for very simple cases. But once you go to exotic ones like DPs, the J invariants of this will start to miss each other very slightly, and we don't know why. So it would be really nice to match. So there are sort of three complex structures here. The complex structure of your Dessan, which is fixed by, which are fixed by number theory. And you've got the complex structure of your dimer, which is fixed by super conformality. And you've got the complex structure of the dual Sasaki Einstein, of the tori in the dual Sasaki Einstein manifold, which is fixed by mirror symmetry. And why is it these three match for simple cases and do not match for more complicated cases? Or what is the story there is something very interesting. So just to get to running out of time, so what is cyber duality in this case? It turns out to be a particular move, which is, we call it urban renewal. I don't know who first coined this term because I think it's probably Hanani. I think because it looks like you're trying to build a house or something. It's like you're renewing this urban grid. But I think Freddie would probably call this the square move, as it's become known in amplitudes. And why is it, why is a square move in computing amplitudes the equivalent to this urban renewal? I don't know. But something that we have shown is that the J invariant of the isoradial dimer for cyclic dual pairs are actually the same. So the J function, the Klein-Jane invariant, the absolute Klein-Jane invariant is actually the same under this move. So it's nice. So in other words, cyclic duality is isogeny for elliptic curves. Let me not go beyond. Let me just conclude with. I never got a chance to tell you some of the more fun stuff that. Let me just conclude with this. I think this says it all. This is a quote from Grothendieck, and I think that this is one of the reasons why this is such a fascinating subject. So I'll let you read it. Thank you very much. Somebody once asked me, you know, as I was emphasizing how Grothendieck was blown away by this, and you know, if Grothendieck was blown away by this, we should definitely study it. And then somebody very astutely pointed out, did Grothendieck say this before or after he went crazy? I never thought about that. But I think before.
Crazy.
Huh?
Yeah, I don't think
you
became crazy.
Some people think that.
He just retired.
He's retired. Well, the best one is what Pierre Cartier says. This is a supposedly overheard at a lunchtime conversation of Pierre Cartier, who was one of the last people who was probably one of the only good friends of Grothendieck. And Cartier said, you know, people say Grothendieck went crazy because of his political views about, you know, how science should not be funded by military and so on and so forth. He says, no, that's not the real reason. The real reason is because what I said to him just a couple of days before he disappeared and went into the mountains. I was having lunch with Grothendieck, Cartier said, and I told him that the speed of light was 2.99 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. And Grothendieck's response was, really? You mean it's not exactly 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second? And then he was never the same man again, and a few days later he disappeared. I'm just reiterating Cartier's story.
Maybe he kidnapped.
Sorry?
Maybe he's hiding. He was hiding
Grothendieck. Yeah, maybe. Oh, but I think that's probably the cutest reason that I know that anybody's claimed why Grothendieck disappeared. Cool. Anyway.
Questions? There are no more. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.